Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. If there's one word which sums up the reaction which most of us had to the revelations regarding the salaries and behaviours of the former CRC board, it has to be the word used by Shane Ross to describe his own response to those revelations at the Public Accounts Committee hearing on Thursday: gobsmacked. Towards the end of a long week in the Public Accounts Committee, which began with the questioning of Irish Water executives and finished up with the questioning of former employees of the CRC and the St Vincent's Hospital Group, Shane Ross was a panellist on Thursday night's late debate with Audrey Carvo.
Shane Ross, you were obviously there today. You did your fair share of the grilling of Brian Conlon. You described yourself as gobsmacked at some of the things he was talking about in relation to his knowledge or lack of in terms of Paul Kiely's payoffs and pensions. How are you feeling tonight?
I'm still pretty shocked, to be honest. Things have moved so fast. It was about 6 weeks ago when I picked up the CRC friends and the accounts and looked at them and said, there's something wrong with this. I could see there was something funny about it and brought it to the PAC. And then we got the top-ups. Then we got, last time, and on December the 11th, we got released to us reluctantly by Paul Kiely, the fact he got 200,000. And we were absolutely shattered by that. I mean, it was extraordinary that he'd got 200,000 tax-free. And now that then we got the resignation of the board. And then now we got the situation where the HSE have sent in their own administrator, and they decided, in effect, to release information, which is, as Kieran O'Donnell said at the thing, it's absolute and utter dynamite. I've never come across a day like it, actually. I don't think in many years in Leinster House where so much, which is so shocking, has come out in this way. It's because this is not ordinary politics. I don't want to over-dramatise it. This is not ordinary, people being greedy or people having different politics, disagreeing. This is the most extraordinary of revelations of a group of people, hopefully a very small group of people, but it tells you an awful lot about Irish society, a small group of people in key areas kind of seizing power and exploiting a situation for their own advantage and taking it out of the weakest and most vulnerable people in society to an extent which is quite mind-boggling. I mean, the figure of 740,000 I've just been on primetime and people have been talking about what Jonathan Owen's just talking about, what that could do for him and for children in his charities. And yet it's just going to one man's pension. I'm still, quite honestly, when I think and talk about it, I still don't quite believe it happened.
Shane Ross on the late debate with Audrey Carvel on Thursday. Also on Thursday, Olive phoned Liveline straight after she heard about the revelations at the Public Accounts Committee hearing. Olive is a former employee of the CRC, where she worked in the clinic's fundraising department.
My fear now today is for my colleagues in fundraising and how they're going to feel directly in fundraising, how they're going to feel about this. And please, I do not want the public to blame them. We did our job. We got the money in. We gave it into a central fund. We had a girl in the office there who was a wonderful manager of our accounts and everything else. Absolutely everything up front. But once it left our accounts department, it then went into the central pool. And that's what Paul Kiely and the others have used. And there's no way you would know that. There's no way you could possibly know that.
Yeah.
You just trust people to be honourable and to be good.
And Olive, you said that you just had to mention those three letters, CRC, and it would automatically generate goodwill.
Yeah.
That's going to change.
That's why I'm heartbroken. I spoke to a colleague of mine last night. We were just chatting and we were kind of saying, about the inquiry going on. And she said, Olive, the CRC were always so well known and in such high regard. And I said, please God, that will. It can't happen now, Joe, because the public, you can't blame the public. Anybody listening to my voice now, they will know me because I did church gates, I did schools, I did flag days. I was known as an individual and I was trusted as an individual. My colleagues, I have two particularly good colleagues in there, the girl who looks after the money and one other particularly good colleague too. We are now going to be questioned. Our motives are now going to be questioned by people who raised money and gave it directly into us. But I can tell them straight off, hand on heart, we knew nothing about what was going on.
Olive, a caller to Thursday's Liveline, also on that same programme. Hazel, a parent of a child who uses the services of the CRC, rang in to give her reaction to the PAC revelations.
My son attends the CRC school in Clondalkin. And I spoke to you there in December, Joe, about the way the services were cut, you know, regarding physiotherapy, speech and language therapy, occupational therapy. And, you know, the children are not getting the service they need, because when you ask why your child is not receiving the amount of therapy they should be receiving, you're told that the funding is not there, Joe.
The cuts.
Because of the cuts. And you tend to believe that because of the way things have gone in the last few years. But now this has come out, and early intervention is so important for these children. I mean, my son used to get therapy on a weekly basis. Now he gets blocks of therapy. He might get 6 weeks therapy throughout the whole school year, which, you know, and to think that this money has gone to Paul Kiley, you know, it beggars belief, Joe, that this can happen.
And it's gone as a donation from funds donated by the public to the CRC. The money donated by the public was subsequently, the board of the CRC decided to take 50% of that as a donation to Mr. Kiley, as if you were shaking the boxes and selling the Santa Bears and running the raffles and running the sales of work or whatever around the country. This is for someone who's already very well paid. This is to augment his already big pension pot.
Exactly, Joe. And he has visited our school on numerous occasions, Joe. And I met him there in March. And that's because I was at a fundraising meeting. As I told you in December, we were fundraising for a summer camp for our children. And he would be very aware of, you know, the facilities in the school. Our school, Joe, is in dire need of a revamp. It needs to be just totally done again. My child is being taught in a prefab, Joe. He moved to the senior side of the school in September, and he's being taught in a prefab, you know. And Mr. Kiley would be very aware of all that, you know. And to think that this money has gone to him, as I said, it just beggars belief, Joe. You know, we're absolutely disgusted. And I know after the revelations came out there in November, I was up in the school on numerous occasions. I try and attend and support the school as much as I can. And I can tell you that teachers, SNAs, therapists, they were actually fine, Joe, because of this. They were so upset that this could happen.
Hazel, a caller to Thursday's Liveline. On Friday's Morning Ireland, another mother whose child also uses the CRC came into studio. Maria Nolan told Gavin Jennings about the kind of care she and 17-month-old Oisin have received at the CRC.
Oisin really needs the CRC. He uses it every week. He goes approximately four times a week. He needs it for physiotherapy, occupational therapy, eat, drinking and swallowing clinic. And I also go to the parent and toddler group myself, which is so vital for me. As with Oisin's condition, I have felt somewhat of an outsider in my own community. So the CRC for me is a lifeline and a second home for me and Oisin.
When Oisin was discharged from hospital, this would be about last September.
Yes, the end of August he was discharged from Temple Street.
And he was quite sick. You used the Central Remedial Clinic pretty soon after that. Tell me about your experience with them.
My experience has been amazing. Oisin was discharged the end of August, and literally while in his discharge process, I received my letters from the CRC welcoming into their family, more or less, and all his appointments were set up immediately, his physiotherapy, occupational, and everything was arranged. I didn't have to ring, I didn't have to follow up, I didn't have to do anything. His appointments were laid out immediately.
Maria, there will be people listening this morning, many of whom will have given money to the Central Remedial Clinic over the years, and many who want to continue to help children like your son, but they're torn now, thinking that, well, last year, for example, half that money didn't go to services, it went to pay off a former boss. What would you say to people who are passing a bucket or a donation and are torn, thinking, well, I want to help, but I don't want my money to go and to pay salaries or to pay pensions like that?
I understand completely. Before I had Oisin, I knew of the CRC, but I didn't know really what it did. I just beg people. I know money is scarce and people don't have money to give, sometimes to charities, but please don't pass the bucket on the street. Do give. Just think of my son. Children like Oisin and adults like Oisin will be like this for the rest of his life. He'll always need the CRC. And please don't pass it. Beg of you, don't pass it. You never know when you might need it yourself. I didn't think when I had my baby that I would need a CRC. And I highly, highly need it. And I will always need it. So please don't pass it.
Maria Nolan talking to Gavin Jennings on Friday's Morning Ireland. Tom Clonan is a well-known voice on radio in his role as a security analyst and commentator. He's also the parent of 11-year-old Owen, who is another little boy who has an ongoing relationship with the CRC. On Friday's Today with Sean O'Rourke, Tom spoke about his family's experience with the clinic.
Owen's disease was diagnosed when he was about 15 months old, so up until then everything had been normal. So we had to come to terms with this new situation. And that was very difficult. You go through a period of grieving and trauma associated with that, sleepless nights. And we still don't know today what the prognosis is for Owen because it's such an unusual and rare condition. But what I would say about the CRC is that the CRC, when we went there, from the people at reception to the physiotherapists, the occupational therapists, the speech therapists, it's an extension of the family and it's an oasis. It's a place that you can go and get the therapies that you need and you find reassurance there. And we can sleep at night because of that. But unfortunately, like everybody else, you know, we have suffered because of the cuts imposed by the government in response to, you know, the fiscal crisis. And like, for example, we had to wait a year for Owen's current wheelchair. So it was prescribed for him last January. And the contract was put out. We didn't get it until last week. So he spent the best part of a year in a wheelchair that was too small for him. And we're parents watching him, you know, grow and develop. His muscle contractures deteriorated a little. His legs began to curl back in on themselves and his feet began to twist in. I do as much physiotherapy with him myself as I can. It's our quality time. We do that at 6:30 in the morning.
Later in the interview, Sean asked Tom about how he perceives the relationship between the care Owen receives at the CRC and the role of its former board members.
Look, I didn't choose, nor did Owen, nor did my wife. We did not choose to be in this space. It happened to us. But no. Everybody on that board chose to be there. And this is how they behave when they interact with families like us and with our children. And again, I would challenge them to come and explain to my little boy why he has to wait for ankle foot orthoses, why he has to wait for treatment and therapy, his physiotherapy, the amount that he gets has been reduced. And again, this is not the fault of individual staff members of the CRC, or I think the HSC are working under very difficult circumstances. But those people in receipt of that money, they should give it back.
Tom Clonan on Friday's Today with Sean O'Rourke. That question of giving the money back was also discussed with PAC Chairman John McGuinness on Friday's Morning Ireland.
Should Mr. Kiley repay some or all of the $750,000?
Oh, there's no doubt in our minds that he should repay it. This is money that came from voluntary collections, and it is shameful and outrageous that the board should have approved that kind of payment and that they would have gone out of their way to put in place a legal agreement, an agreement that stated it was a confidential agreement and that it should not be spoken about. This was agreed by that board. So they deliberately constructed to mislead and to hide the fact that this was publicly collected money from voluntary sources and that they were paying it to Mr. Kiley. So there are questions around how this money was paid from one group into another for the salary and pension of Mr. Kiley. And there are legal issues here. So Mr. Kiley should come forward and he should refund the money to the Central Remedial Clinic as soon as possible.
PSC Chairman John McGuinness talking to Cathal McQuilla on Friday's Morning Ireland. This was also the week in which the Dáil reconvened after its Christmas break. And the politicians were certainly back with a bang on Wednesday when Tánaiste Éamon Gilmore challenged Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin about remarks he had made about the government's handling of the establishment of Irish Water.
You of all people are in no position to come in here and to talk about spending in any state agencies. You commissioned 145 consultancy reports when you were Minister for Health at a cost of 30 million. You spent 220 million on the PPARS project, which which never saw the light of day. Meanwhile, your government presided over a neglect of water services in this country to the point where people in Galway couldn't drink the water because it was contaminated. The money you wasted, Deputy Martin, on consultants' reports, you'd have established Irish water three times over.
Tánaiste Éamon Gilmore, as heard on Wednesday's News at 1, reacting to comments made by the Minister for the Environment, Phil Hogan, that he can't be expected to micromanage the setup of Irish water, Fianna Fáil's Barry Cowan had this contribution to make to the debate.
Minister Hogan says he shouldn't be expected to micromanage €180 million. It's not as if we're asking Phil the price of the new gym down there in the HQ of Irish Water. What we're talking about here is 50% almost of the setup costs of €180 million. €85 million we're talking about. And Minister Hogan and his government wants us to believe that he only asked one question. How much do you want, lads? That's what he asked him. Okay, we have €180 million, sure you can collect it on the way out. And then we're led to believe he went into the cabinet to agree a budget for 2013, and he had a few heavy hitters facing him there. Ministers Noonan, Howland, Minister Clovney, Varadkar, Burton and Bruton. And they had only one question to ask too of Phil. Have you enough in €180 million, Phil? That's all they could say to him. And then last week on Carlow Radio, Phil feigns surprise at the €50 million figure. That's excessive. That's quite high. That shouldn't be the case. Let's check that out. Better call them in and see what's going on. Minister Coveney and Varadkar, Burton and Bruton, they feign surprise too. Because they remember they didn't ask any questions when it was at the cabinet. Minister Gilmore, the Tánaiste. Oh, that's a very high price. That's a lot of money. We'll have to check that out. He wasn't thinking that when Phil went into the cabinet looking for 180 to set up what is the biggest super quango we've ever had.
Fianna Fáil's Barry Cowan has heard in an excerpt from Dáil proceedings on Wednesday's late debate. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. News of the violent death of Tom O'Gorman last weekend was made all the more shocking by the suggestion that his death in his home in Castleknock in Dublin had come about over disagreement over a game of chess. On Friday, we heard that 34-year-old Savario Ballante from Sicily had been remanded in custody after his court hearing was adjourned. On Monday's Today with Sean O'Rourke, the editor of the Irish Catholic newspaper, Michael Kelly, who is a friend of the late Tom O'Gorman, gave his reaction to the death of his friend.
This loss has really been profoundly felt today, obviously principally by his sister and brother, Catherine and Paul, whose loss is immense, but across the wider Catholic community and the various different causes and organisations that Tom was involved in here in Dublin and both nationally as well.
And he was a contributor to your newspaper, The Irish Catholic, is that right?
He was, yeah, less so in recent years. He'd spent a lot more of his time working in the Iona Institute, but he always retained a passion for journalism, and he contributed regularly to the Irish Catholic on all kinds of issues. And he was a wonderful journalist, a very sharp mind. I think anyone who knew Tom would describe him as having an extremely sharp mind. He loved to debate things, and he was wonderful to debate and discuss things with, because if you ever thought you were going to get off easily just making a casual or glib point, then you would never get away with it with Tom, because he was someone who really wanted to tease something out, and he really brought that to his journalism and his research work as well. He had a great passion for the whole pro-life cause, was very much involved in the pro-life campaign going way back to his days as a student in UCD. That's something that he felt very passionate about, and I think passionate is probably a word that can be used to describe Tom. There were no half measures when it came to his love of films, similarly, and his love of football, of Irish rugby, of Leinster rugby. He really had a profound love for all of those things, and as a result, had a very, very wide circle of friends and moved very easily between those different circles.
People clearly, including yourself, must have been utterly shocked at the news that you heard yesterday morning. How did that word spread?
It's actually hard even to take in. I would say there's a sense of numbness among people. Even just talking about it now sounds surreal, hearing his name in the headline. News spread very quickly yesterday by about lunchtime that Tom had died in some kind of terrible incident in his own home. And I would say, Sean, that shock deepened during the day and during the night as the details of it emerged. For anyone to die is a terrible thing, but for Tom to lose his life in such terrible circumstances, people are really devastated and people are very numb.
Irish Catholic editor Michael Kelly talking about the death of his friend Tom O'Gorman on Monday's Today with Sean O'Rourke. Operation Transformation 2014 is well and truly up and running by now. You might have followed the early stages of the delight of this year's leaders when they were selected to take part in the programme. But what's it like when the excitement dies down and the contestants realise that there's no getting away from those television cameras? On Monday, security guard and Operation Transformation leader Mark Gibbs told John Murray how he's been coping.
You know, it's been a bit of a shock to the system for the simple reason, you know, literally I wasn't expecting my cameraman to be outside my house at 5:30 in the morning last Tuesday morning. That was a huge shock. I actually got up out of bed and I says, you know, I'll get up and I'll get myself sorted before the cameraman arrives. And I came down the stairs and he was standing in the garden and the light was on and the camera was ready and
action.
Wow. That was a huge reality check. I actually felt, you know, I felt a little bit depressed about that, you know. That night, I mean, I was apprehensive in any way, and I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I said, I want to leave the country. You know, if I had the money, I'd jump on a plane and I'd get out of here. You know, I don't feel that I want to do this now. You know, it really hit home to me. You know, I knew he was coming, but it was just the reality of...
of the intrusion.
Of the intrusion, and... I had a panic attack. I had an anxiety attack. I was sweating, you know, and I was scared. I genuinely was. I really didn't want to do this.
And since, have you grown more used to the cameraman being there, the predator, as they're called?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, you know, he really puts you at ease. And,
what's his
you
name?
You know, I feel that he's my pal now. Jim. I feel that he's my pal. Jim
he's gone from being
now.
A terror now
yeah,
to being a...
I mean, I had a bad morning with him Saturday morning. I was after working 4 shifts on the trot. I was extremely tired.
You work in security?
Yeah, I work in security. I was living in a house of 7, you know, getting into work, coming home at 10 o'clock, leaving. Jim would be there. I mean, I was dreading, you know, I was saying, God, Jim's going to be there when I get home. You know, will you get out of my face? Like, you know, it was getting to me a little bit. And
so there's a third person in your marriage at the moment?
Absolutely.
So at this stage of proceedings, you're getting used to it, but you're still finding it a bit all too much.
Absolutely. Getting a little bit used to it, but I had my moments. Definitely had my moments Saturday morning. I have to apologise to Jim for that.
Okay.
I did have a go at him.
If you're listening, Jim. What did you say to him, by the way?
Well, I got worked... I got worked up a little bit about the breakfast.
Yeah. And when you say you had a panic attack, a full-blown panic attack?
Oh, absolutely. Sweating.
Yeah.
I was, you know, sweating and
okay.
I definitely wanted to run away.
Operation Transformation participant Mark Gibbs talking to John Murray on Monday. On Monday night, the BBC aired a television documentary which featured an in-depth interview which Ian Paisley did with Eamon Malley. On Tuesday's Today with Sean O'Rourke, the former deputy leader of the SDLP, Seamus Mallon, gave his reaction to Mr. Paisley's portrayal in the documentary.
He portrayed himself as a conviction politician. And if you take it at face value, he certainly was. But yet here was a man of conviction who on... Had he tells us now, a conviction about the killing of people on Bloody Sunday, yet he said nothing about it. He had concerns about civil rights objectives, yet he said nothing about it. A man of conviction without the courage of his convictions. That is something that I think, again, was transposed into his portrayal of himself as the man of the people who took on big house unionism. He did, certainly, in Wales. But you see, once he got the smell of power, and once the hands were reached out to him in Dublin and London, what is the first thing that he did? Did he do it in relation to people and issues? No. He made himself and his wife and others members of the House of Lords, and himself a member of the Privy Council. so that I think it gives you some indication of the type of priorities that he brought to politics. He fomented problems. He goaded people into reactions that may not have been as harsh as they were. And when he talks about tolerating things like civil rights, I remember the remarkable day in Armagh and the civil rights march in Thomas Street, where he led a mob which took over the town, which broke into a hardware shop. They armed themselves with pickaxe handles, and this small civil rights march that was moving down Thomas Street were beaten off the street. It was my first sight at first hand of the absolute snarl of sectarianism that he had portrayed so many times in so many places in the north of Ireland. And I think of all the political memories on the streets at that time, that is one that will last with me. It's a far cry from the smiles that we have seen that he has been able to produce of late.
Seamus Mallon as heard on Today with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. The details of the alleged extramarital affair of French President François Hollande received lots of coverage in the airwaves this week. On Monday's Morning Ireland, Cathal McQuillan spoke to Elaine Cobb, CBS correspondent in Paris, about how the French media has been covering the story.
Looking at some of the French media, as I was doing over the weekend, there's a way of covering this story, which is to say, look how fascinated the Americans and the British are, for example. But that's a kind of a roundabout way of covering it without covering it, isn't it?
It is. That's not so much prudishness of getting around France's privacy laws, because the laws are very strict in what you can write about someone and how much of their private life you can get into. Now, the fact that Tahrir Fallah is also a public figure by virtue of her position means that they can discuss certain issues in as much as they affect public life. And if you've got a split possibly coming in the first couple, then that is a public issue. So there's a lot of debate here over, you know, just how far can we go? What exactly can we say? And how much can we remind people of the past as well? Because let's not forget that Tahrir Fallah moved in with François Hollande in 2007, just as soon as he split from his longtime partner, politician Ségolène Royal, when the two of them agreed to go their separate ways and immediately took up with the other people in their lives.
He is obviously a much more fascinating man in his private life, it appears, than in his public life, where he's seen as Monsieur Normal, dull,
but
if anything.
Is meanwhile, normal, Carl. This is France. It's perfectly normal.
Let's not go there.
You have a mistress.
Elaine Cobb talking to Cathal McQuillan on Monday's Morning Ireland. Later that day, on Drive Time, Mary Wilson spoke to reporter Peter Allen, who gave this update on that same story.
Well, the latest we hear is that Ms. Triviolet, the First Lady of France, has decided to book herself into a hospital for her fourth night. She's not suffering from any medical condition. She's just exhausted and humiliated, I think. Her representatives say it's a case of the blues. Has left quite a few people in France wondering whether this is a great use of hospital resources, though, I must say.
Normally in France, a person's private life and a president's private life would remain just that, private. This time, it has been blown all over the front pages by those revelations, first in Closer magazine. It is deeply embarrassing for the French president. Is he saying anything?
He's not said much. He initially said a few sentences, which he released as a private individual and not as the President of France, which, again, I think made him look a little bit stupid. He is the President of France. Nobody can argue with that. He said that he was shocked by it all. He was looking at ways to take legal action, not because the stories were untrue or weren't investigated properly, which they were, simply because they invaded his private life. Now, a lot of people are saying, and I have a lot of sympathy for them, is that this isn't actually a debate about the private lives or public lives. It's a debate about the status of the First Lady of France. We'd all know that over the last few years, First Ladies have become extremely important in public life. Look at Michelle Obama in the USA. France has a First Lady, and yet, let's be honest, whatever you think about her, she's been treated abominably. And if this carries on, she'll have no sympathy at all and she'll be out of the Elysee Palace within days.
And Mr. Hollande's former partner, that's the mother of his four children and at one time a presidential candidate herself, Ségolène Royal, she has rowed into the debate now. What has she been saying?
She's been, if I may say so, very presidential about it. Ségolène, I think, to be honest, is enjoying the whole thing because she absolutely detests Valérie Trierweiler. There's plenty of evidence, and it's been proved on numerous occasions, that the relationship between Ségolène Royal, as you say, the mother of François Hollande's four children, overlapped with that of Miss Trierweiler. And indeed, when Ségolène was standing in an election last year, Miss Trierweiler actually tweeted support for a rival candidate. This made her extremely unpopular because Ségolène is actually quite a popular figure still in France. So there's real hatred between those two. But as I say, I think Ségolène is dealing with it in a very sort of refined presidential manner because she doesn't want to lower herself to what which she would see as the level of Valérie Trierweiler.
Reporter Peter Allen talking to Mary Wilson on Drive Time on Monday. On Thursday, we heard the news that the legend that is Mick O'Dwyer is finally retiring. He spoke to Sean O'Rourke about his decision.
Yes, it is the end in management, and it was certainly Sean, yeah. And I got my ankle done in the meantime, so I'm getting ready now to play the golf links here in Waterville and to do a bit of fishing.
And there's no coaxing you back, even maybe to give a bit of advice, not necessarily taking the training sessions?
Oh, well, I mean, if that would be a different story completely. That would be completely different to managing a team, I can assure you. Yes, that's something I could do all right.
And I suppose if called upon to give some advice. Now, it began, I think, with your minor career with Kerry footballers in 1954, 60 years ago, as we say. If you were to pick a few standout sort of achievements or moments or even regrets over those 60 years, what would they be?
Well, I suppose the one that stands out most of all would be winning my first All-Ireland medal in 1959 with Kerry. I mean, being the first Waterville man to achieve that, that was a major achievement for me, and that was the one I think that stands out above all others. Then, of course, winning as a manager in 1975 against Dublin, who were raging hot favourites at the time. That would be well in line. And then, of course, going to Leinster and winning with Kildare and Laois. There were two big moments in my life as well.
And what about again, we're going back a little bit now, maybe 10 years or thereabouts. There was a strong suggestion that there was a move on to draft you to manage the Dubs. How close did that come to actually happening?
Well, just pretty close, I can assure you. I was appointed, I think, actually, nearly appointed. We met a couple of us in the K Club to have a big chat about it, and it was nearly done. Arthur French was also involved in that management as well, and he was going to go to see all the junior clubs and intermediate clubs in Dublin to check out the players. So it was nearly done for one day, and then the following morning I decided not to take it.
You decided or they decided not to have you? I mean, was it just...
Well, I suppose it hadn't gone to the county board at that stage and they would have made the decision. But, I mean, people at top level in the county board, John Bailey at the time, he made a big effort at him to get me to do it. So, yes, he said that he would appoint me. So that's as far as it went.
GAA legend Mick O'Dwyer talking to Sean O'Rourke on Thursday. Also on Thursday on The Mooney Show, inspired by a forthcoming production of Seven Brides for Seven Brothers in Dublin, Brenda Donoghue met up with three brides and three brothers in Donaghmead. Bridie, Phyllis and Carmel are married to David, Gerard and James, and Phyllis told Brenda how their multiple romances first blossomed.
We all lived in Jim Larkin House. And we actually...
And where was that now? Tell
in the
me.
North Strand.
Yeah, and were they flats or what?
Yes, they were flats. And they had really and truly fantastic families came from there. And we actually lived up on the top of the flats. We thought we were in the penthouse because we were up on the top. And underneath us was another lovely family. And underneath that was the Redmond family.
Which is ye boys, is that right?
Yeah.
Now, there was 10 children... In our family, we had five boys and five girls.
This is the Irish Brady Bunch.
The Brady Bunch, exactly.
Yeah.
And two floors underneath, there was the Redmond Bunch.
Yeah.
So we had to pass their house when we went up and down the stairs. And we were all just going up little nippers. And what happened then? We all fell for one another. My sister Carmel, she got married first to David. I met my lovely husband, Jim, at the wedding. And we
of Carmel and David?
Yes.
Oh, my God. So yes, Irish yes. one.
Yes. And then when I got married, who met her husband, only Phyllis and Gerrit.
Wow.
And when my mother heard that, she could understand just the first two and the second two. Oh, my God, but third, not another Redmond is coming into my house.
I believe you all go on holidays together. How does that work out, David?
Well, it works out fairly well, except for the receptions at the hotel when the three of us show up. Yeah. And they're trying to figure out Mr. Redmond, Mrs. Redmond, who is married to who, yeah. and what room will we give them. Yeah. And when we come to pay the bill, we have already paid, so we say, oh, that's great. But it's the wrong Mrs. Redmond who's paid. Yeah. So it gets very confusing and amusing to see the look on their face when they're trying to sort it out. So we have to explain to them how it's that we're three brothers married to three sisters.
Members of the extended and extensive Redmond family talking to Brenda Donoghue on Mooney on Thursday. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. What would you do if you got to meet Robert De Niro and Sylvester Stallone, even if you are meeting them in a professional journalistic capacity? Wouldn't it be hard to resist the temptation to have a picture taken to capture the moment for posterity? Well, when 2FM Weekenders presenter Paddy McKenna was recently sent to interview Bobby and Sly, you can understand the predicament he found himself in.
I called De Niro Bobby. I was like straight in there. All right, Bobby. And he was like, hello. And I said, I'm Paddy from Ireland. And he said, top of the morning to you.
Oh, God.
And, you know what? You're Robert De Niro, any other Irish stereotypes, I will dance an Irish jig, whatever you want. But very quickly, we met beforehand, and I met the publicist, and she said to me, whatever you do, can't get a picture with the two lads.
This is a common thing on those things. You're not allowed, really.
But before I came over, everyone says to me, you have to get a picture. Yeah. So that was weighing on my shoulders. Like, if I don't get out here without a picture, I'm a fool.
Your persona non grata.
Once in a lifetime opportunity, etc. and so forth. So she said that, and I went, mm-hmm. And you can't get a picture with them. So I shook hands with them anyway. Well, you did the interview.
Did they even have a good handshake?
Good firm handshake.
Okay,
yes,
good. That's
definitely.
Good. Yeah, good.
We did the interview and went really well. And at the end, I got up and I halfway across the floor, I remembered, Jesus, the photo that I'm not supposed to take. Can I have a photo with you lads, if that's all right?
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun.
Publicist gone out of the room. Two lads are like, yeah, sure, no problem. Then the publicist basically comes out with the brickwork of the watch. She's like, no, you can't do that. I told you. So I put the head down, feeling a bit bad, feeling a bit bold.
Yeah.
And slank out of the room, if there is such a verb. And then from behind her, I could hear De Niro just going, in Robert De Niro's Godfather voice. The only way I can describe that.
Yeah.
Come on. Come on. He's Irish. It's like, hang on. Glimmer of hope. Then Stallone weighs in. And he says, you do realise this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for this young man or anybody else.
This is Sylvester Stallone actually standing up for you.
This is Stallone and De Niro
ganging
up on the publicist, which I did feel a bit bad about. She's just doing her job.
Yeah.
So she kind of just poked me back into the get over there. And I handed her the camera and I thought, she's never going to take this picture.
Yeah.
Well, fair play to her is all I can say. Despite everything, she took the picture. I thought, oh, she's going to do shaky. No. Hopped in behind the two lads. All right. Mr. Stallone and Mr. De Niro. And De Niro's just saying to Stallone, again in the Godfather voice, this guy, kind of pointing at him. And that was it. I got it. I went outside. We had a bit of a moment where the publicist just said, I thought you were one of the nice guys.
Oh!
I was like, I'd prefer it if you were angry than disappointed in me.
Paddy McKenna and Ruth Scott on Weekenders on 2FM last Saturday. Another superstar, astronaut Chris Hadfield, was on Barscaelta, Radio na Gaeltachta's weekday magazine programme, which comes from Donegal. As you'll hear, the senior infants class of Gaelscoil Bhun Cronacha had a go at teaching Gaeilge to the world's most famous astronaut.
A hen.
A hen.
A door.
Door.
Tree.
Tree. A hen, door, tree.
Cahir.
Cahir. Quig. A hen, door, tree, cahir. Quig. She.
Shocked.
Shocked. Oct. Ni. Jai.
Gorma
yogurt.
Gorma
yogurt.
Dormish Buddha Boston, the poisty bugger.
Yeah.
Could you do your shibboleth press Chris Hadfield.
Miss Misha, Chris Hadfield.
Spasara me agus me imon an ISS. Hanek me go heren margo wilsam agam I kultur na heren. Tadul agam san omanch. Sayuhol agus changa gailig. Welta heren fioralen acta dunegal specialta.
Astronaut Chris Hadfield as heard on Barshgaelta on Radio na Gaeltachta on Tuesday. Belfast poet Sinead Morrissey was announced this week as the winner of this year's prestigious T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry. And on Tuesday's arena, she spoke to Sean Rocks and read some of her poems. This poem, Lighthouse, is about her six-year-old son, Augustine, who sometimes finds it hard to sleep.
My son's awake at 10, stretched out along his bunk beneath the ceiling, wired and watchful. The end of August. Already the high-flung daylight sky of our northern solstice dulls earlier and earlier to a clouded bowl. His Star of David lamp and plastic moon have turned the dusk to dark outside his room. Across the lock, where ferries venture blithely, and once a cruise ship, massive as a palace, inched its brilliant decks to open sea. A lighthouse starts its own night-long address in fractured signalling. It blinks and bats the swing ball of its beam, then stands to catch, then hurls it out again beyond its parallax. He counts each creamy loop inside his head, each well-black interval, and thinks it just for him, this gesture from a world that can't be entered. The two of them, partly curtained, partly seen, upheld in a sort of boy talk conversation no one else can hear. That private place, it answers, with birds and slatted windows. I've been there.
The winner of this year's T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry, Sinead Morrissey, has heard on Tuesday's Arena. That's about my lot for this week. To play us out, on Thursday's Mooney, three young men who met in the UCD Choral Society came into studio to perform their version of the Rembrandt's I'll Be There For You, better known as the Sig tune to Friends, which, as it happens, first went on air 20 years ago this week. The version, which Oisín O'Callaghan, Glenn Murphy and Ronan Scollard have produced, has to date been viewed more than 200,000 times on YouTube. I'm Fiona Kelly. So until next week, goodbye.
No one told you life was gonna be this way. Your job's a joke, you're broke, love a life's DOA. It's like you're always stuck in second gear when it hasn't been your day, your week, your month, or even your year. But I'll be there for you when the rain starts to pour. I'll be there for you
like I've been there before.
I'll be there for you 'cause you're there for me too. Still in bed at 10 and work began at 8.
You missed the bus again,
hair's not looking great. Your mother told you there'd be days like these, but she didn't tell you when the world has brought you down to your knees. That I'll be there for you when the rain starts to pour. I'll be there for you
like I've been been there before.
I'll be there for you, 'cause you're there for me too. Cause you're there for me too.